Okay. Well, thank you, Fabio, and thank you also, Sumati, for inviting me. I will steer immediately some discussion. I was actually happy to receive this title. I'm one of those who actually is in favor of abandoning XLT as a term, as opposed to Wiskott, and I'm more in favor of talking about severe and milder presentation of the disease, and we may discuss perhaps why. All right, so I was given a number of questions, and I tried to arrange my presentation in order to answer these questions. So there was one interesting question, and I think the interesting is mostly in the bold font here. What are the real chances of success for hematopoietic stem cell transplantation? In general, what are the chances of survival also after stem cell transplantation? What is the recommended age to undergo transplant? What is the youngest recommended age? What is the oldest possible age, or perhaps even oldest recommended age? What are the most serious and not serious complications? What percentage of patients have serious long-term complications, and for how long should we be worried? Now, we're talking about a rare disease, and as it often happens when you have rare diseases, you need, in fact, large collaborative studies, and I think this is something that you play a very important role in by participating at collaborating networks and registries that collect information on these patients that undergo transplant. This is the only way, really, to make a sense of all of these questions. We also need to consider that things evolve, and there are a number of variables that have a major impact in answering your questions. So consider there is improved matching between the donor and the recipient over time, and so the outcome of transplant 20 years ago, and I'll try to show this, is not what we have now. There are alternative available treatments that are as important as transplant per se, in particular supportive care. Pre- and post-transplantation has made significant changes and improvements over the time. And there are also specific drugs that are now available and weren't available years ago to fight specific infections as well as complications of transplant. So it is an evolving story and will remain an evolving story, and we have to understand that. Okay, so what factors really affect survival following transplantation? What are the key factors that affect survival? The most important factor is probably the matching of the HLA system between the donor and the recipient. But I also want to emphasize three other significant factors. The year of transplantation, which is something, of course, we can't control because, I mean, you're born and then you get a transplant in a specific year. The clinical status of the patient at transplantation, this is something that perhaps we can control. And age of transplantation, which actually was one of your questions. So let me review a little bit what has happened in that regard. So the first large collaborative study on outcome of transplantation in patients with Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome was a study that was produced, again, by an international collaborative network at the CIBMTR that collects information of patients undergoing transplant in the United States, North America in general, but also other countries in the world. And Lisa Filipovich from Cincinnati was the leading author of this paper. And this is actually, it doesn't project. Does it? No, it doesn't. It does? Okay, I don't see it. All right. So anyway, on the y-axis, you have probability of survival, and then there are, as you see here, different curves. Oh, yeah. And so these, you see, is the best survival curve with 90% of the patients surviving up to 5 years post-transplant, and really you have mortality only relatively early after transplant, but then no patients died afterwards. So this is the best scenario. It was the actual identical sibling. And then there were other curves for other donors. And so in particular, this is another related donor. So typically, it's either the father or the mother. And you see here the survival is clearly worse than the actual identical sibling. In this study in 2001, 50% of the patients actually died, and most of them died early after transplantation. And then you have two different curves, patients who received a transplantation from an unrelated donor. And what is the difference between these two curves? So these were patients that underwent transplant at a young age, less than 5 years, pretty good survival, almost identical to what you get after transplantation from an actual identical sibling. This is a curve for patients who underwent transplant at over 5 years or more of age, much worse survival, with virtually only 20% of the patients surviving 5 years, and the actually overall survival was even worse. So that actually indicates that the type of the donor, but also the age of transplantation, did make an impact. Now, this was 2001, and after that, things have evolved. And so these are the results of a study that we undertook, an international collaborative study. Again, it's a retrospective study with the limitations of all retrospective studies. And Daniele Morata from my former institution was the first author. Now you see here, this is focusing on patients who received transplantation from an unrelated donor. Remember the two curves that I showed you in the previous slide, one that went very well, but the older patients that didn't do well. And now you have here, again, patients who are over 5 years at the age of transplantation, they're doing much better. Now we have 75% survival. So in a matter of 10 years, the results of unrelated donor transplantation have dramatically improved. And again, the reason for this is that we have better ways of identifying matched donors, unrelated donors, than we had 10 years before. There are more donors available. There are better ways to prevent complications of this type of transplant. So clearly, there is now a significant improvement in the results of transplantation, even when you don't have a matched sibling donor, a match-related donor available. There are other factors. I mentioned year at transplantation, and again, same study, and now looking at the outcome of transplant regardless of the donor type, according to year of transplant. And so before 1995, overall survival around 70%. In the most recent series, around 90% or over. So again, overall improvement over time, which is, again, reassuring and I think important. The clinical status of the patient at the time of transplantation has some impact. Not a dramatic impact, but some impact. So this is actually Dr. Ochs' score, which is important in at least in defining how bad the clinical history of the patient was at the time prior to transplantation. So these are infants that actually had what we would call a milder form of the disease, or XLT, if you want, went to transplant with a score less than 3. These are patients with classical Wiskott, but not the most severe form of Wiskott. These are patients who had developed either autoimmunity or malignancy, and so because of that, had received a score of 5. And there is some difference in the survival, but again, all groups, including those that had serious complications prior to transplant, had a pretty good survival rate overall, around 80% long-term. So, which is, reassuring again. Now, things are evolving even further. And so one of the problems that we had until recently is that the score that Hans proposed is really looking at infections, autoimmunity, and malignancies, plus eczema, as the main determinants. But as you all know, the platelet count may also matter. And so there are patients who actually remain with an extremely low platelet count and may suffer from serious hemorrhages. So this study from the group in Paris looked at actually the outcome of patients who had an early onset and severe form of Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, in particular identifying what they call patients with severe refractory thrombocytopenia. So these would be males with Wiskott that never go above 10,000 platelets, remain all the time with less than 10,000 platelets. So are these different than the other patients? Is this a special risk category? And so as shown in this cartoon, in fact, many of them did do rather poorly. There were deaths prior to transplants, there were also deaths after transplantation, and there were sequelae. And so based on that, they actually proposed to modify the score of Wiskott now by including this group of early onset severe Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, where you have refractory thrombocytopenia as a key element, and they identify this group of patients as being also candidates to early bone marrow transplantation, irrespective of the presence of serious infections, autoimmunity, or malignancies. And this is all something open for discussion, but I think they have a good point in here. All right, so how early and how late can we intervene? What is the advantages? What are the advantages of intervening early? What are the disadvantages of intervening early, and how late can we intervene? So There is no question that you do need to use chemotherapy to perform successfully transplantation in Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. But we all know that chemotherapy is toxic. And so chemotherapy is particularly toxic in very young infants because you still have a developing brain and you do have organs that are not fully capable of handling the chemotherapy. So we always are nervous when we have to propose a transplantation very early in life. The general strategy that we use is to wait, if possible, at least 4 to 6 months of life in order to accommodate for some more time for brain development and also prevent some major risks, in particular complications of transplantation like veno occlusive disease, which would be more frequent if you use high-dose chemotherapy and hit the liver early in life. There are some risks also of other, and there was a question about this, other long-term complications with regard to an impact of the chemotherapy on tooth development. And again, I mean, I should say that there are data in the literature on the long-term effect of using chemotherapy for transplantation and the impact on the teeth, but these studies pertain to patients with cancer. And so the complication there is that these patients were already exposed to chemotherapy as part of the treatment of their cancer, and on top of that, also an additional chemotherapy, and in many cases even radiotherapy, which is a different type of treatment, to prepare for the transplantation. With that caveat, there are data that in fact if you perform transplantation at an age less than 3 years, you in fact are at increased risk of agenesis of permanent teeth, and which teeth in particular, first and second premolar, but also the molars. The difference is one tooth per person. You're not losing, you know, all of your premolar and molars. But if you're asking a question, is there an increased risk? The answer is yes, there is an increased risk. Now you have to balance that, to weigh that, against the risk of waiting too long before going to transplant. So it's always something that has to be discussed on a case-by-case basis, depending on the severity of the disease. But what about later age? Well, one could say, well, then let's wait if possible. But there are also complications associated with waiting too long. The incidence of graft-versus-host disease is actually higher if you go to transplant later in life. And this is especially true if you go to transplant from unrelated donors. So in that sense, it's better actually to receive the transplant at younger age. For Wiskott in particular, these patients, as we have discussed already, you know, with Dr. Candotti and Dr. Ox, they are at increased risk of viral infections, and some of the viruses would be viruses that remain in the body forever. Herpes viruses in particular, they remain in the cells of the body, and they can reactivate. And, of course, that carries significant risks post-transplantation at the time when the chemotherapy hits your immune system, and then you remain totally without defenses against those viruses. So risks of reactivation of viral infections are actually higher if you go to transplant later in life because your chance of having encountered those viruses becomes higher. Now, keep in mind that until 10, 15 years ago, many patients with Wiskott, unfortunately, would die of EBV, lymphoproliferative disease. EBV is one of those viruses, post-transplant, just because of this problem. Now we do have ways to treat it, but still, I mean, the risk is there. There's also an increased risk of worsening of the disease with age because Wiskott is something that can hit you throughout your life, and so you may develop an immune disease, you may develop organ damage. And I showed you the slide that actually if you go to transplant with a higher score, your survival rate is a little bit lower than if you go to transplant with a much better clinical shape. So for these reasons, perhaps, it's not so good to wait too long before transplantation. So higher risk of complication post-transplant. So the general idea is that the transplant should be done in the first years of life. But again, there is no golden rule here. Everything should be discussed on a case-by-case basis. What complications and what's the rate of complication? There was another question I was asked. So there are complications that are related to chemotherapy, and some of these are actually transient. They are relevant only for some period of time, post-transplant in particular, because of the use of chemotherapy, you will be in need of transfusional support, and you may have complications related to the anemia, to the leukopenia, but you also have other types of complications that are very common, post-transplant, the diarrhea, the vomiting, the development of oral ulcers, but also hair loss. All of these are transient. Infections are a little bit more of a problem, again, because you're hitting the bone marrow. You would remain without also neutrophils for a period of time. You would be lymphopenic. That would expose you to bacterial, fungal, and viral infections, as well as to reactivation of these viruses, CMV and EBV. In this study that was done in 2011, approximately a little bit between one quarter and one third of the patients had infectious complications, serious infectious complications post-transplant. Graft-versus-host disease is something we all worry about. There are two types of graft-versus-host disease that you probably are familiar with. That's an acute graft-versus-host disease, typically defined as something that happens in the first days, 100 days, 11% of the patients had this. Chronic, which may or may not follow, often does, but not necessarily, 5.5%. This is, you know, this can be very severe, but, you know, this is something that unfortunately you have to deal with, and quite often unsuccessfully in many cases. So this is a, you know, long-lasting problem. You may develop organ damage as a result of graft-versus-host disease, as a result of chemotherapy, I mentioned, being an occlusive disease, and also as a result of infections. And then there was one thing that I was asked to discuss, and I will do it at the end of my talk, and I thank you because it forced me to read about this, infertility and what can we do to prevent fertility in male children at prepubertal age. Other complications, autoimmunity. So the immunity not only happens pre-transplant, it may also happen after transplant. There is really no correlation between the type of autoimmunity that WISC patients have pre-transplant and the type of autoimmunity that they will develop post-transplant. So the autoimmunity you have pre-transplant doesn't predict what you will have post-transplant. It's a relatively common complication, 14% of the cases. The most common is actually autoimmune hemolytic anemia, which is relatively common early post-transplantation, in the first year in particular. But there's also thyroid autoimmunity, which is common. And so this is something to watch. Hemorrhages, and I'll discuss this in one slide, they are obviously associated with a low platelet count. And there are really three reasons why you can have a low platelet count post-transplantation. One reason is that the transplant hasn't taken very, very, very well, in particular in a myeloid compartment, including the cells that eventually give rise to platelets, you may not have a good engraftment, and you remain with your autologous cells there, and so, of course, your platelet production would remain low. You may have graft-versus-host disease, in particular chronic graft-versus-host disease, which may affect the bone marrow, and then you remain with low platelet count because of that, or you may develop an autoimmune thrombocytopenia post-transplantation, and this also happens, and that may lead to a low platelet count. Graft failure, either primary lack of engraftment or graft rejection, 7% of the cases. There are also cases of declining chimerism. And so where you start with a good engraftment of the cells from the donor and then those progressively drop in terms of percentage. What does that mean? What is the implication? Well, first of all, let me summarize here that patients who receive cord blood transplantation, patients who receive mismatch transplantation, although things are improving even here, and patients with a high clinical score at the time of transplantation, these are three situations where the risk of having complications is actually higher. So these are the patients who got cord blood transplant. These are the patients who got transplantation from the father or the mother. 60 to 70% of them develop complications post-transplantation, which is very different than, for instance, this group here, clearly a lower percentage of complications, 25-30%. These are the ones that got transplanted from a matched sibling. And again, these are patients who went to transplant with a low score, a milder form of the disease, XLT if you wish, at a lower rate of complications as opposed to patients who went to transplant with a severe forms of the disease. So again, one reason why you want perhaps not to wait too long for the transplantation. I mentioned the dropping chimerism, and so a situation we call where you have coexistence of donor and autologous cells, mixed chimerism. And now, if you look at the platelet count here and focus on the non-splenectomized patients, these are the patients with WISC pre-transplant. These are the patients who had full engraftment, so all of the blood cells in these patients are donor-derived. Very good platelet count, totally normal, with some range, but virtually all of the patients had a normal platelet count. These are patients who are mixed chimera. where you have some cells from the donor, but some cells also from the patient. And in that situation, you can clearly see that the platelet count is lower. It's higher than it was pre-transplant, but it's lower. And some patients actually remain profoundly thrombocytopenic. So just to talk about splenectomy, I would not worry considering splenectomy in that setting. You really want to fix the thrombocytopenia if possible. And in fact, this is a situation now with a splenectomy that even those that had mixed chimeria now remain with a good platelet count. I would not suggest and advocate to do splenectomy if you're thinking of going to transplantation. But if you remain profoundly thrombocytopenic post-transplant, splenectomy is something to consider. The other issue that is associated with mixed chimerism is a higher incidence of autoimmunity. So you really want, as much as possible, to obtain full engraftment from the donor. That should be your goal. Totally correct your blood compartment with donor-derived cells. Don't have any from your own. And so, to do that, unfortunately, we do have to use intensive chemotherapy. So we do rely upon what we call myeloablative chemotherapy, because the use of reduced intensity conditioning quite often results in this situation. It may or may not fix your thrombocytopenia, may or may not prevent a risk of autoimmunity. So that's the only way to obtain robust and durable multi-lineage engraftment and disease correction. I'm showing this slide, which has to do with immunization, because I already expressed my opinion that if you are profoundly thrombocytopenic post-transplant, you should seriously consider a splenectomy. But in that case, you should absolutely do a proper course of immunizations. And there are now very effective vaccines. I would also add that actually the recommendation from the CDC for the patients with Wiskott are to do extensive immunization even if you don't receive splenectomy. And I think this may not be necessarily relevant for patients who are receiving IVIG because they receive a supply of antibodies through the IVIG. But if you have what you call XLT or what I call milder form of the disease, there is no question that I would strongly advocate for receiving a full course of immunization as recommended by the CDC. In my personal experience, this doesn't happen all the time. And so this is something that we as physicians, as a medical community, and you as association, I think we have to work together to make sure that each patient receives a proper course of preventive therapy, in this case, immunization, against a number of pathogens, which are, in fact, very important for patients with Wiskott. There was a question about influenza, and I'm glad that the question was asked. Yes? So it is important to immunize patients with Wiskott, milder or severe, against influenza, not because the influenza itself is dangerous. When you have influenza, you create a transient damage to your upper respiratory tract, where we carry these other bugs here, in particular pneumococcus. And pneumococcus is very dangerous for patients with Wiskott and milder or severe form of the disease. So if you happen to have influenza and you have pneumococcus in your nose, the pneumococcus may actually penetrate and may result in sepsis. By immunizing against influenza, we protect the child against influenza and prevent the risk of, largely prevent the risk of serious pneumococcal disease. You had a question?
If they're not showing good titers, would you recommend them being immunized more?
So I should say, you know, that's another question. So we use, the titers are a surrogate measure, and that's the best we have, to define whether a child has been protected against influenza. The real answer is that the only way to know that is to know whether he catches or doesn't catch the influenza. Okay, so that's the only real answer. So anything else we do are surrogate measures. They're the best we have. I think, you know, what I would do, I would just recommend immunizing with a killed influenza vaccine, the shot, you know, of course, not the mist. That's enough. I wouldn't personally bother measuring the titer. Just give the shot. That's all what you have to do. You can do better. That's as good as you can do. Okay? All right. So do we have a consensus about transplant? I think I showed you that my preference would be to advocate for transplant in patients with severe clinical score, so the severe form of the disease, and of those. For those patients of any age, including those very young, who completely lack expression of the protein, those are at very high risk of developing serious disease sometime in their life. Severe refractory thrombocytopenia is an indication for transplantation early in life, even in the absence of other serious complications like autoimmunity, infections, and malignancies. Transplant from matched sibling donor, as well as from unrelated donor well matched, 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10, gives excellent chances of survival and cure. Results of haploidentical transplantation from a father or a mother, are not as good, although they are improving. And so there is further room for improvement there. You need to use very robust chimotherapy, and patients with mixed chimerism and severe thrombocytopenia may benefit from splenectomy, may benefit also from this other drug, romiplostim, and there is now a trial open with eltrombopag, which is another agent which can be given orally. And so it would be interesting to see what the outcome of that would be. There was a question about quality of life. I think actually you are the best to answer this question, and there will be a final presentation today, so I'm not going to talk about that. But of course, there is a need to wait, in fact, for this study, because there are otherwise no data really in the literature on the long-term quality of life of patients undergoing with whisk or undergoing transplantation. Is it improving over the years or not? And finally, a question that we often are not asked, and so it was interesting for me to look at this, is prevention of fertility in patients with risk of receiving transplantation. A few, you know, background data. Most of the data are actually derived with regard to the impact of transplantation and chemotherapy or radiotherapy on fertility are derived, again, from patients with cancer. And what do these data tell us? That use of gonadotoxic agents during conditioning regimen may, in fact, affect the germinal epithelium and cause azoospermia or oligospermia. So there is no question that a chemotherapy may impact on fertility. How high is this risk? Well, the risk of infertility is dependent on the type and intensity of the therapy. High-dose conditioning regimen, especially those that include radiation, total body irradiation, may cause azoospermia in over 90% of the cases. But as you know, we don't use, as a general rule, total body irradiation as part of the conditioning regimen for Whiskard. Azoospermia is less frequent in patients conditioned with busulfan and cyclophosphamide, which has been a classical way to perform transplantation in Whiskard, 50%. Uncommon in those treated with cyclophosphamide alone, 10%. You may be familiar with new strategies now to do transplantation and use cyclophosphamide post-transplant even from mismatch-related donors, so this would be interesting to follow. And although scarce data are available, it appears that also chronic graft-versus-host disease and not just the chemotherapy may adversely affect sperm recovery. So overall, you know, many reasons, in fact, to worry a little bit, or maybe not a little bit, but much, in fact, about the risk of fertility. So how to preserve fertility in patients with whiskers? Well, there are many consensus statements by several societies that now indicate that universal access should be available to sperm and egg storage for patients undergoing gonadotoxic therapies. Now, according to a study from the UK, though, how often is this done in practice? The number of patients who were counseled about the gonadotoxic effect of transplantation increased from 42% before 1990 to 86% in the contemporary era, which means nonetheless that 14-15% of patients still are not even told about this risk at the time of transplantation, which I think is important. There are guidelines that have been developed by ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Again, all of this is mostly in the cancer setting, but we can actually use some of these guidelines and apply them to the whisker situation. So for adult and adolescent males, and only applies, of course, to post-pubertal age, banking of sperm is the correct approach to preserve fertility. So if you have, you know, a patient with whisker with an adult or an adolescent, the sperm should be collected prior to the chemotherapy. Absolutely. This is what all of the guidelines strongly recommend. However, most of the patients with whisker will eventually receive transplant at a pre-pubertal age, and there is no possibility for these males to produce sperm for cryopreservation because they don't even have yet mature sperm. So what can be done? Well, all of this is now experimental, but there are many centers, and at least I found several in the United States, that are working on this. So one thing one could do, and again, this is all experimental, so keep in mind that we're talking about experimental approaches, is to perform testicular biopsy, isolate and store what are called spermatogonial stem cells. These are not sperm cells. They are progenitors of the sperm cells, and they, in fact, they need to mature further and divide their chromosomes before becoming sperm cells. And then once, you receive the transplant, you are fully cured, you mature, and then these cells are thawed and transplanted back into the testis in what is called the Rita testis, and they will differentiate and mature in the right environment and eventually produce sperm and hopefully give rise, in fact, to offspring. So that's one way to do it. There are other ways to do it. So this is the classical way, what should be done. If you have a postpubertal adolescent or adult, you store the sperm. And then the only way, though, to obtain children would be to undergo this procedure, which is called intracytoplasmic sperm injection. So you need basically to have the egg from the donor, and you inject the sperm from the patient that had been stored into the cell, and then you implant the embryo into the mother. That's how it's done. It's an in vitro fertilization through an intracytoplasmic injection of the sperm that had been stored. If you have a prepubertal male, that's what I just described, the biopsy of the testis, the storing of the spermatogonial stem cells, and then, retransplanted or even cultured and then transplanted and then back into the patient. And this would be a normal fertilization now. Or other approaches, disrupt the tissue, do organ culture, autotransplant, but then you have to use this strategy. The future might also be even this one, where you take other cells, and this would also apply to patients who actually have already undergone transplant. You could take skin cells, which are called fibroblasts, reprogram them to a pluripotent stem cell stage, and those actually can be further differentiated in vitro into spermatogonial stem cells or progenitor germ cells, or even, according to some reports, to haploid germ cells, and then be used for obtaining offspring. All of these is, at this time, highly experimental. There are problems associated with this process of reprogramming, so none of this is clinical applicable at this time, but it may become a reality. I just want to give you the message that what is not possible today might become possible in the future, and for sure this approach is likely to become possible in a clinical practice. It is still experimental. You can ask, there are several centers, at CHOP, at UCSF, many hospitals in the United States are willing to discuss this possibility with you if you're interested. And I stop here.